What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is the rabbi of the Wilshire Boulevard Temple Camps in California, Rabbi David Eshel. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. We've just returned from a wonderful trip to the Mediterranean, visiting some of our favorite Jewish places in the world. I've always particularly enjoyed the Italian Jewish community, which began well over 2,000 years ago during Roman times. The first permanent Jewish residents of Rome came during the Maccabean Wars and helped bring Roman assistance to the battle between tiny Judea and the mighty Greek Seleucid Empire. And Jews have been living in Rome ever since. By some accounts, the great Roman Colosseum was constructed by Jewish slaves after Titus's conquest of Jerusalem and was funded by the treasure he took from the temple before destroying it. The Arch of Titus, which overlooks the Colosseum from the Forum, has classic images of Roman soldiers carrying away the great golden menorah of the temple as captured booty. By custom, any Jew who walks through that hated arch is automatically excommunicated. When you factor in the Italian invention of the ghetto, the first walled enclosure for the Jewish area of a city was in Venice in the 1520s, and the long papal oppression of the Jews in Rome and the rest of Italy, including the papal Inquisition, you would think that visiting synagogues, museums, shops, and neighborhoods of such a country as Italy would be depressing. And yet, that is definitely not the case. In fact, on the contrary, the Italian Jewish community, while no longer large, is very proud and impressive. Its liturgical music is unique and beautiful, its cultural life rich, and as you would expect in a country deeply dedicated to artistic beauty, its ritual objects and vestments are uniquely beautiful. Restricted by bigotry and religious hostility to just a few occupations, the Italian Jews nonetheless managed to create fortunes trading in used clothing and leftover junk, taking the leavings of society and turning them into successful industries. And once the creation of the nation of Italy broke the anti-Semitic limitation on Jewish religious buildings, the Italian Jewish communities created some of the most magnificent synagogues ever built. My own favorite might be the Temple of Florence, a large and fantastically intricate and wonderful synagogue sanctuary in a fabulously ornate and lovely structure crowned by a majestic dome. My wife Wendy's favorite is the Synagogue of Rome, an even larger dome and an elegant, bright, gorgeous interior. Even though the current Jewish population of Italy is no more than 20,000, perhaps, fewer than the Jews in my own city of Tucson, they maintain a proud and diverse community. Being Jews, of course, they have not one main tradition, but a number of them. It's not that we Jews don't get along exactly, it's that we insist on doing so in separate small groupings, nearly always. And so the original Jews of the Italian tradition, Nusach Roma, maintain their synagogues and their liturgical traditions. And the Levantine Jews who came from the Levant of Turkey and Syria have their traditions and their synagogues. And the Sephardic Jews who came from Spain and Portugal to Italy in the 15th and 16th centuries have their synagogues and their traditions. And the Jews who came later from Spain and Portugal and were hidden Jews there, conversos, have their synagogues and their traditions. And the Jews who arrived from North Africa have their synagogues and their traditions. And the German Jews of Ashkenaz who came to Italy have their synagogues and their traditions, and the Jews of Provence, France, who came to Italy, have their synagogues and their traditions, and nowadays the Chabad Lubavitchers, who come mostly from New York, mostly Brooklyn, have their synagogues and their traditions. It's bewildering, even to knowledgeable and experienced Jews, and it is totally typical of Jewish communities all over the world. And of course, in their daily lives in Italy, all these Jews speak Italian and are Italians, but Jews of their own flavor as well. During the short period we were in Italy, there was a Hebrew cultural festival in Rome, the opening of a small new Jewish center in Florence, and Venice's small population of Jewish artisans and merchants have developed some lovely new products to sell to us Jewish tourists, like hand-blown glass shofarot from the island of Murano. All interesting, rich, and diverse. We also had great Jewish experiences in other countries, spotting a kosher tapas place on La Rambla, the famous pedestrian walkway in Barcelona that is literally filled with tourists and locals each night. Perhaps best of all, we went to the extraordinarily wonderful Musée Marc Chagall in Nice, France, which taught me something extremely important about the place of art in our lives. For me, it's impossible to travel in Europe and not experience the incredible wealth of art and architecture on display everywhere in a way that it's simply not available in the United States. We do have fine museums and great buildings here, but we have had far fewer centuries to accumulate masterpieces, and there's something amazing about seeing great creative work everywhere, as you do in so many parts of Europe. On this trip, we saw a great deal of fabulous art and architecture. But the Chagall Museum touched something deeper. I've always liked Chagall's paintings, have some prints in my house, but never have I seen such a beautiful display of his best work as there is in this lovely place, his museum, in the very pretty city of Nice. And after viewing fantastic art in Spain, Italy, and France, it was a revelation to see paintings where I had no need whatsoever of looking at the explanatory cards on the wall to see what the images represented, because they were filled with Jewish images and ideas, fantastic scenes from the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh, the creation, Adam and Eve, Noah and the flood, Abraham and Isaac, Abraham and the angels, Jacob and the ladder, the angel wrestling Jacob, Joseph and his brothers, Moses crossing the sea and at Sinai and bringing water from the rock, King David, the Song of Songs, and many, many Midrashim, all woven in, all in vivid colors and sweeping construction. It was fabulous to see the great paintings in the Uffizi Gallery and in Rome and the Doge's Palace in Venice, to enjoy Picasso's museum in Barcelona and Gaudi's amazing Sagrada Familia Cathedral there, to marvel at the many religious paintings and sculptures of Christianity and the extraordinary pagan images of Roman and Greek sculpture. But the unique experience with Marc Chagall of seeing our own Jewish images, pictures, ideas, and stories shown so vividly helped me to understand just how powerful art can be when it touches our own experience more directly. It helped me to realize that while great art explores and expresses the human condition and the sacred yearnings of our hearts, we need not share the direct religious or cultural life of the artist to appreciate it and be moved by it. When it truly reflects aspects of our own tradition beautifully and powerfully, it becomes something more. It changes not only our perspectives, but our hearts and minds. Chagall made me appreciate these familiar biblical stories and ideas in new ways. His vivid colors brought the Torah home in fresh, rich ways. And watching my own children, now teenagers, see these paintings and understand them without needing to use booklets or audio guides was a revelation. Imagine that. Great Jewish art portraying meaningful Jewish subjects. You expect it in Israel, of course, but finding it in France, in snobby Nice, of all places, was pretty terrific. Well, it's good to be home, and somewhat sobering to realize that Rosh Hashanah is just a month away or so, and that this week we begin the final month of the Jewish year, Elul, in which we blow the shofar every day, heralding the upcoming arrival of the 5774 year. To play us in this morning, here's Tekaba Shofar, sound the great shofar of freedom for the coming month of Elul.
Tekabi shofar gadol lechirutenu, mesanes, mesanes lekabes galuyotenu, bekabtenu yahad mehera, mehera, me'avakan kotaretz le'atzenu.
Shofar gadol lechirutenu, v'sa, v'sa, kabetz, ve kabetz, galuyotenu, ve kabetzenu yata mehera, mehera,
ve arbatan fotaret, ve yatzenu. Teka!
Vekabetzeinu yachad mehera, mehera,
ve'arvatan fotaret le'yatzeinu. Teka, teka,
teka b'shofar gadol,
teka b'shofar gadol,
teka
b'shofar gadol,
teka b'shofar
gadol,
teka b'shofar gadol,
teka b'shofar Mehera, mehera, ve'ar bakan fotares le'atzeinu.
That was Tekaba Shofar, sound the great shofar of freedom uniting us under God's rule, we pray, in this coming final month of the Jewish year, Elul. Well, summer is nearly over here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, not in terms of the weather, but because public school starts this week and vacations are ending. To celebrate the summer that's nearly past, our guest this morning, Rabbi David Eshel, the camp rabbi of two outstanding Jewish summer camps in California, the Wilshire Boulevard Temple Camps, will explore what makes a camp experience so terrific for Jewish kids and helps keep Jews Jewish. Learn all about it when we return on Too Jewish in just a few moments. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics. And they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Craig difference at Jim Craig Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all new body style. It looks absolutely great. And it's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now a vent price of just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Craig difference.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish this morning Rabbi David Eshel. He's a rabbi at Wilshire Boulevard Temple in Los Angeles, and part of his portfolio is to be the camp rabbi at the Wilshire Boulevard Temple camps, two really outstanding camps, Hess Kramer and to a degree also Gindling Hilltop, which he has some authority over here in California. Good morning and welcome, David.
Good morning. Thank you.
So explain what's really radically different about a camp experience from another kind of Jewish educational experience for a kid, for a Jewish kid?
That's a wonderful question. I think the main difference is that this is not just an educational experience, but it's complete Jewish living, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, right? It's constant learning. It's both explicit and implicit. And you are immersed in Jewish time, in Jewish life, rather than going to a place for, say, overt Jewish education and then going home and continuing what you think is a compartmentalized, separate part of your life.
You know, one of the things we tend to think about camp, we think about, you know, Alan Sherman, Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, for as old as I am, or, oh, it's a great, fun experience, and then they go back to real life.
the goal of a Jewish camp is a little different than to say, okay, you've had a great time at camp, now go home and you'll come back next year and start over. How do you get some of that continuity?
Well, that's a great question, too. The Hello Mother, Hello Father camp that you, as you say, I think there's a difference. There's a difference between a Jewish camping experience versus a camp that happens to have a bunch of Jews going to it, right? Where a Jewish camp, somebody coming from the outside, or if you were in a helicopter hovering over, and you may see the same things, say basketball or arts and crafts or soccer or
swimming, archery.
Any of the, archery, all of those kind of things. But the underlying thing, right, is living by a set of Jewish values, right? Yes, that they could also be called universal values, but we have a very particular way of expressing them, right? That one of the best quotes I ever heard from a child, from a camper, they said to me, you know, Rabbi Eshel, I don't just come here to learn something. I come here to learn how to be someone. And I think that's the real difference, because it's not that they, when they leave here, the experience is done. Right? They take it with them. It's giving them the tools and a place to practice, the tools that are really going to make them better human beings.
Whether or not they're saying Hamotzi and Birkat Hamazon, you know, the blessings before and after every meal, they're taking some of those values back home with them.
Correct. It's the way that they treat each other in the cabin, right? The respect that they have for each other, right? It's the way that they learn how to deal with conflict. It's the way that they learn how to nurture friendships and talk to people face-to-face and really live with each other.
Right. We will talk much more about camp life and what makes it distinct with Rabbi David Eshel when we come back on Too Jewish.
Among my most pleasant, at least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my own grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the totality of the Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know of anyone who might qualify for the 2013 Kohan Award, just visit our website, www.kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, and you'll find the nomination form to submit. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-A-W-A-R-D. It's a good visit.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road Office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio, or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there or the Apple iTunes Store as popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome for the final time here on Too Jewish our maven on Israel for the more than the last 3 years, Guy Gelbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center, now moving back to Israel, returning home. Boker Tov, Guy. Good morning. Welcome again for a final time on Too Jewish.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So, final thoughts before you head back. Also, now that you're a radio star, you know, how has this experience been for you? Putting Israeli life and perspectives on American life from an Israeli today's perspective and perspectives on Israel into 3-minute segments for 3 years.
You know, I think that's the main point of what you just said, and maybe that kind of summarized the whole experience of a shlichut, of being a shaliach in the U.S., the need to take a whole arena of Jewish identity, connection to Israel, Israeli politics, Israeli life, Israeli culture, and summarize that into a 3-minute spot on the radio. a Jewish identity pill, an Israel pill that someone can swallow and become more Jewish or more supportive of Israel, or you say what?
Understanding everything in 3 minutes. It's pretty impressive.
And it's, I think for me, that was maybe the essence, because when you need to come on the spot, like I had to do, whether it was in this radio talks with you, with your very challenging and interesting questions, or whether it was in lectures I gave across town, or in programs we did through the Heartbeat, or Young Family Engagement, you know, the Hanukkah party, and Tu Bishvat Ardi party, and Sukkah Shake, and all of those, you need to ask yourself a lot of questions. For example, you come to do a Tu Bishvat event, and you ask yourself as a shaliach, how do I make that something that brings Israel? How do I, you know, what in my Israeli Jewish identity is unique and can be brought into this event and make it different? And same goes with any interview or any article that I wrote to the Post. It's really sitting with yourself and reflecting and asking yourself those very challenging questions that in Israel I never got to ask myself.
Fascinating. And, you know, it's this interaction that I think makes the Israeli-American experience so rich and challenging, but exciting and fun and constantly different, because it's always a somewhat different perspective as much as we share. And that difference, I think, is very enriching, very special.
It is. And I want to use this opportunity to thank you, Rabbi, for giving me this opportunity to speak on your Two Jewish radio show. I'll keep following the radio show through the internet.
Through the magic of the internet.
And I thank you, and I thank all the audience for listening and taking part in this journey, in this magical journey.
Guy, I want to thank you as well. Todah rabah lecha for all that you've done and for how well you've represented Israel, and what a pleasure it's been to have you here as on the radio show and as a friend. And a siyah tova, a safe trip, a good return, and don't forget us.
Todah rabah.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, Egypt has been extremely interesting over the course of this summer. It's no longer the Arab Spring or the Arab Summer. I don't know what it is in Egypt. What are the different elements in Egyptian society that are all kind of floating around in this Nilotic mess?
Well, it's clearly a very fluid situation. But as we said a couple weeks back, Egypt has a special history in the Islamic world, and even more special in the Arab world, in the sense that it's one of the very few Arab countries that has a real national identity that wasn't just carved out of the Ottoman Empire or given random boundaries by the Brits and the French. It was the home of an ancient civilization, and Egyptians are very nationalistic. Since about the 10th century, they have been kind of the intellectual headquarters, if not the cultural headquarters, of certainly the Arab world, if not the entire Islamic world. They have some famous universities and centers of Islamic learning. They were also, for many centuries, a great center of Jewish life, both Alexandria and Cairo.
Right.
So already you have a situation which is unique. You also have a very poor country without the saving grace of oil resources or any other sort of miracle ticket to prosperity. Egypt depends for what little prosperity it has on agriculture. Traditionally, it was the breadbasket of the Roman Empire, and then, of course, Egyptian cotton. And all that depends on utilizing water from the Nile. It is still largely an agrarian society. It's largely pre-industrial. So you have all the shifts that European countries went through a century or two ago of rapid urbanization, industrialization. Plus, you have the fact that for most of the past 2,500 years, Egyptians have been living under somebody else's rule, some foreign power, the Greeks, then the Romans, then eventually the Arabs, but the Arabs who came from Saudi Arabia, and then eventually the Ottoman Turks for many centuries, and then the Brits. So Egyptians have very little recent history, and by recent, I mean like two millennia, of self-rule. And hence, the tendency that we're seeing now, whenever something goes wrong, it's not the fault of the Egyptians. It's U.S. intervention or British intervention or somebody pulling the strings, or the leader who was so disappointing, like Morsi, was disappointing because he was a U.S. puppet, not because his, in the eyes of most Egyptians, not because his agenda didn't correspond with that of many Egyptians. And when we talk about agendas, and there's absolutely no consensus, and you're right that there are disparate groups which have different agendas, and I think we should talk about each of those agendas and each of those groups when we're together next week.
Absolutely, and maybe a little bit about the socioeconomics of Egypt, which I've never understood. Thanks very much, Tom. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Two Jewish as a Public Service. Moshe is visiting a cemetery and he hears the crying of a woman. He goes to investigate. He finds her at a grave, weeping and sobbing. "Oy, Abe, it's been 4 years since you left me, but still I miss you so much." So Moshe asks her, "Who are you mourning?" "Mein husband," she replies. "He was wonderful. Every day I miss him." But Moshe notices something strange. She says to her, "Your husband?" "But on this headstone it says, 'In memory of Frida Goldberg.'" "Oh yes," she replies. "He put everything in my name." That was the old Jewish joke of the week. A special feature to Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and keep something in your name. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion from Deuteronomy is called Shoftim, Judges. It establishes a process for the administration of justice and includes one of the most powerful statements in all religious, philosophical, or ethical tradition. Tzedek, tzedek tirdof. Justice, justice you must pursue. In the Torah, which has no kefel lashon, no extra words, a repetition of a word means that it has additional importance and power. Here, the word for justice, tzedek, is repeated, emphasizing that justice is extraordinarily significant. We must be not only fair in life, but truly just. Even more than that, the Torah teaches us that we must not only be just, but tirdof, pursue justice. Chase after it, make it a goal for our lives and our civilization. It's not enough to act well in a place where justice is not the norm. We must strive to change an unjust situation into a just one. Tzedek, tzedek tirdof. Each of us must pursue true justice. It's easy to understand that for Jews, justice underlies everything good in society. Without justice, there is no peace. Without justice, there is no morality. Without justice, we simply can't trust our government or its leaders to act well. Even love is only truly possible where there is respect and a sense of fairness, which are, in essence, aspects of justice. Be just, God commands. Never accept injustice as a permanent condition of life. Chase justice in your own life. Work for justice in your society. And then good will come. It's a great and holy message in a society like ours in which the pursuit of happiness sometimes seems to be the goal, but the better pursuit Indeed, the most meaningful real pursuit for us is justice. May our actions and our words help to make our society more just this week, but also in the coming new year of 5774, just about a month away. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Rabbi David Eshel, will explain what is unique about the ways that values, like justice, are communicated at Jewish camps and how they help shape dedicated, caring young adults when we come back on Too Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia, the power to surprise.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Talks between Palestinians and Israelis resumed last week, the first such formal deliberations in 3 years. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has been pressing the sides for resumption of negotiations. He's visited the region 6 times since he got the post in February. Most people thought this wouldn't happen, and yet, here it is. The Israeli side in the negotiations is represented by Tzipi Livni, the Justice Minister, and for about 5 minutes, the Prime Minister of Israel, and Yitzhak Molcho, the National Security Advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. Saeb Erekat, the top Palestinian negotiator, and Mohammed Shtaya, who directs the Palestinian Economic Council and has ministerial status, represent the Palestinian Authority. As Secretary Kerry announced on July 19th in Amman, Jordan, the Israelis and Palestinians have reached agreement on the basis for resuming direct final status negotiations, the State Department has announced. It has not elaborated on what that basis is or will be. The meetings in Washington mark the beginning of these talks, the State Department continued. They'll serve as an opportunity to develop a procedural work plan for how the parties can proceed with the negotiations in the coming months. In other words, they're negotiating on how to negotiate, but still. Israeli and Palestinian talks have been suspended since October of 2010 when the Palestinians walked out over Israel's refusal to extend the 10-month partial settlement freeze. A number of leaders in the Israel Beitenu, the Jewish Home Party, led by Naftali Bennett, and in Netanyahu's own Likud party have suggested in recent weeks that a two-state solution, particularly one based on the 1967 lines, is not viable. As these talks proceed, it'll be interesting to see if Netanyahu will continue the talks and still hold his coalition government together. Martin Indyk, the former U.S. ambassador to Israel, past guest of Too Jewish, has been appointed by Secretary of State John Kerry and President Barack Obama to be the special envoy for this Middle East peace process. We wish him the best of luck. Rabbi Aaron Pankin was selected president of the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, my alma mater, or one of them, by its board of governors. HUC, the International University and Seminary for All of Reform Judaism, made the announcement last week. Pankin, who is 49 years old, has taught rabbinic and Second Temple literature at HUCJIR since 1995 in New York. He has also been vice president for strategic initiatives, dean of the New York campus, and dean of students. As president, Aaron Pankin will serve as the chief executive officer of HUC's 4 campuses, Cincinnati, Jerusalem, LA, and New York. Pankin, the 12th president in HUC's 138-year history, succeeds past Too Jewish guest and personal friend and mentor, Rabbi David Ellenson, who served from 2001 to 2013 and is now moving upstairs to become chancellor. I am greatly honored to be called to serve as the president of HUCJIR and to strive for ongoing innovation and creativity in strengthening our institution as the intellectual center of progressive Judaism worldwide, Aaron Pankins said. Our mission is to help our students grow into authentic Jewish thought leaders, able to articulate and advance their own visions of a rich Jewish life for a new and rapidly changing religious landscape. Pankin was ordained by HUC in New York in 1991, an alumnus of the Wexner Graduate Fellowship. He got his doctorate in Hebrew and Judaic Studies at NYU, where his research focused on legal change in rabbinic literature. He serves on the faculty of the Wexner Foundation, the editorial board of Reform Judaism magazine, has served on the Rabbinical Placement Commission, the Birthright Education Committee, the CCR Ethics Committee, and in other leadership roles in the Reform movement. We are proud that Dr. Pankin will be leading our institution, Erwin Engelman, the board chairman, and Marty Cohen, chair of the Presidential Search Committee, said in a joint statement. He is a distinguished rabbi and scholar, dedicated teacher, and committed leader of the Reform movement for more than three decades. We wish Aaron bracha v'hatzlacha on his appointment. He is a bright, capable guy, and although he has very big shoes to fill in those of David Ellenson, he should do very well. Our Meshuggah news desk reports that Turkish authorities last week detained a bird on suspicion it was spying for Israel, but freed it after x-rays showed it was not embedded with surveillance equipment after all. The wandering kestrel aroused suspicion in Turkey because of a metal ring on its foot carrying the words 24311 Tel Avivunya, Israel, prompting residents in the village of Altaneva to hand it over to the local governor. The bird was x-rayed at a university hospital to check for microchips or bugging devices, according to a Turkish paper, which carried a front-page image of the radiogram with the title Israeli Agent. Ties between Turkey and Israel, long military allies, have been tense since May of 2010 when Israeli commandos killed nine Turkish activists aboard the Mavi Marmara, the ship in the Turkish-led convoy trying to break illegally a naval blockade of the Gaza Strip. Although Turkey continues to struggle with its own internal political discord and has had huge protests against the Islamist regime of Tayyip Erdogan, in recent months the U.S. has brokered a rapprochement between Turkey and Israel, much to both countries' relief. And now this wandering bird has been proven to be an innocent avian rather than a Mossad secret agent. Good news. Finally, in an attempt to show that dictators, too, can bask in the glow of the early bird filter, a lot of birds today, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has joined Instagram. The account, which goes under the name Syrian Presidency, shows Assad's softer, friendlier side when he is not killing civilians, smiling, waving, shaking hands with laughing children. Syrian First Lady Asma al-Assad, who grew up in Britain before marrying Bashar in 2000, features prominently in all the photos. A week old, with 100 posts in that first week, the account welcomes visitors to the official Instagram account for the presidency of the Syrian Arab Republic, and it already has over 5,000 followers. Meanwhile, the Syrian civil war has claimed 100,000 lives so far, averaging about 7,000 casualties a month, many of them civilians slaughtered by Assad's troops. Wonder if that will be on his Instagram messages anytime soon. Oh, one more thing. Ozzie Schenkman, a 6-foot-tall guard who scored the very first 2 points in the history of the NBA way back in 1946, passed away last week at the age of 94. Schenkman was a Jewish kid from LIU in Brooklyn. He averaged 8 points a game that year and, very briefly, was the first scoring leader in National Basketball Association league history. In that inaugural season, the whole team payroll, by the way, Schenkman recalled, was about $60,000 for the whole year, less than most players in the NBA earn per game now. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world.
We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Rabbi David Eshel. He's a rabbi on the staff of Wilshire Boulevard Temple in Los Angeles, one of the historic congregations in Southern California and in the country, actually. And also the camp rabbi, or basically stays at camp over the course of the summer at Hess Kramer Camp, Gambling Hilltop Camp in, it's really a tough part of the world, Malibu, California.
Yes, we summer in Malibu. Yes.
Yeah, not so bad. Now, that is a unique advantage not every Jewish camp
absolutely,
has.
Absolutely.
I don't remember beach days when I went to camp as a kid. But I don't think that's the most extraordinary thing about the camp. just my personal, you know, observation, you know, it's very rare to see boys who are, you know, 8 years old to 16 or 17 hugging, warm, gentle, sort of expressing this extraordinary level of warmth. You see it all the time at this mm-hmm. camp. Tell me why.
I think it really comes down to something that we really try and teach here, is that this is a place where you can become your best self, right? It's a safe place to experiment, try new things, push yourself, a safe place to fail and pick yourself up, because you know that there are going to be hundreds of other people right there to help pick you up. And it's because it's like family, right? Time and time again that campers refer to this place as their second home or their other home, right? Not just a place to be, but it's people to be with. And the love that you see between people is really the love that you see among family. And I think that's nurtured, and it's safe, and it's comfortable.
You know, America is a competitive place, and our values in this society are, while there's lots of different wonderful values, freedom, and so on, are also to compete. I don't see that. I mean, there's avid competition, but about things that you wouldn't expect. You know, people are formed into teams, and they compete at something, but it's a different kind of flavor to it. I don't see kids competing one-on-one against each other the way we see it so often in our society. Is that a conscious choice? Is that a decision the camp makes? Does it just kind of grow out of the culture?
I think it actually grows out of the culture, but there is, I mean, not to say that there isn't competition, right? Because we have sports, and there are winners and there are losers, right? We have something that we call a Maccabia, or a color war, where we divide the camp into four teams, and there's competition throughout the day, and there are winners and there are losers. I think what you see is healthy competition and learning that it is okay to lose, right? It's how does one lose? What do you do with that? And how do you win, right? The gloating or something like that, it's not there, because it's also, hey, it's great, you won, but you know what? You're not always going to win. You lost, but you know what? You're not always going to lose. So I think that is one of the underlying values in competition, because we think we want to push you to try new things and strive, right? And in that, there's always going to be competition, but you're not always going to win and you're not always going to lose.
You know, it's interesting. As a rabbi, one of the things you hear from your own kids, but also from other kids, is, if I go to Jewish camp, I'll be praying all the time. And yet, when I see the kids here doing blessings before and after meals, they're having a fantastic mm-hmm. time. They're enjoying it. They're doing shtick. They've got all their camp games and stuff. Mm-hmm. But they really enjoy the experience.
Correct.
They enjoy prayer. They enjoy the songs, all the Jewish songs that they're doing.
Correct.
Intensely. And you see all kinds of kids dancing. It doesn't matter if they're good at it. They're having a great
Correct.
Time.
Correct.
How is that? Again, I kind of want to wonder, is this something that just has grown up? Have there been some specific choices? What's too much Jewish stuff? How do you balance mm-hmm. it?
That's a great question. And yes, it's always choices. We often speak of the magic of camp, right? But everything that we do is really done with real thought and intention, right? And trying new things. And I think it also comes back to living in a place like this and having staff that buy into a vision, right? What you see is not just a snapshot of one moment in time, but really work that we've been doing with these kids and teenagers over many, many, many years. I mean, this is my 13th summer at camp.
Your bar mitzvah.
My bar mitzvah year, yes. And the oldest counselors at camp, who are now 20 years old, were my first campers when they were 8 years old. So we don't know camp without each other.
Right.
Right? So it's work that we've all been doing with these kids as they're growing up, that we have a vision of what we want, where we want to be, and how it is that we're going to get there. And that takes time, slowly but surely, building up a culture, building up intention, building up education. Right, where then these counselors, where these campers are now the counselors who are teaching the next generation. right? So I'm less concerned, you know, even I'm less concerned with them being able to recite certain prayers or remember certain dates or facts, but I'm more concerned with how they are developing as human beings, Menchi human beings, and the terms and the being able to discuss facts and dates and those kind of things will come. But the way they treat each other and the way that they treat themselves and the way that they open up, that's the real magic, right? That's the real work. And it's all connected to the tefillah because it's work that we've been doing and introducing over many, many years. And when the younger kids see the older kids doing it, they want to do it as well. And they make it seem like, quote unquote, cool. But it's not really any different than what could happen, say, in supplementary education in the religious school. Like, you can even still introduce the same tunes and everything, but it's not going to work, or it hasn't worked in my experience yet,
right,
because of this fact that it is so compartmentalized.
You're there for 2 hours on a Tuesday.
Exactly,
or
and then you go home and you have X, Y, and Z you need to do. You need to do homework. You have soccer practice. You have football practice. You have baseball practice. You've got dance. You've got ballet. You've got all of these other things. But at camp, you're at camp. You're living your life. This is infused into your existence.
So it's a very special environment, besides which, you know, beautiful views and a lovely place, mm-hmm, and people who've grown up here. In making that a special place, it seems to me that taking that out and finding a way of doing that is something that the American Jewish, both conservative and reform movements, and I suppose every part of Judaism, have been trying to take this into supplemental education and
correct,
even into day school education.
Correct.
To have more time, a more inclusive environment, and never really succeeded. Is there something that we're not doing right?
In supplementary education,
you
mean?
In supplementary education in particular.
It's not a matter of doing right or wrong. I think it's a mistake to think that you can bring this to it in the same effective way. Again, it goes back to, because, you know, doing something in just 2 hours a day versus living and eating and sleeping and breathing and with these people 24 hours a day, 7 days a week is completely different. And they're also away from their parents,
right?
And they're forced to form these relationships and learn how to do that. It's not to say that you can't have elements that you can bring from camp into supplemental education, right? But then again, it's how are you going to train your staff and
right,
getting the right staff?
And keeping right? the staff and
keeping
that,
the staff,
nurtured,
homegrown right? staff, right? Yeah. That buy into a vision, right? That aren't just looking at it as a secondary income or an extra thing for them to do, right? Or a job. But this is really
or
about.
Remember the way they did it at home and think it should be slightly different or significantly different and sort of buck the system along the way.
Yeah. And it's about a vision. It's about feeling that you are a part of something greater than the self.
Which is kind of what Judaism is all about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this, there's no greater laboratory for that than here. And, you know, you said something earlier that I want to touch on, this idea of real world versus, you know, this kind of bubble. You say you leave this place and have to go back into the real world. I believe that this is the real world versus the masks that we wear outside, right? Because here we say that you're down to, you know, your real, your best self, the essence of who you are at a place like this.
You get to the Ikar, you get to the root.
You
of who
get to the
person.
Foundation, right? You yeah. get to the roots, you get to the foundation, right? And in a place where you are comfortable and where you are supported to then help others reach that as well. Now, if you could bring the real to what's on the outside, you know, Gan Eden, right? But
paradise would be achieved. Paradise found.
But the truth is, you know, one of the things that we're lucky here is we don't have, like, the kids don't have to worry about where their meals are coming from.
Right. It's all
right?
There.
It's all taken care of.
Right. And yet, I will tell you something, as a dad, not as a rabbi, when my kid comes home, he's used to bussing his own table. He's used
correct.
To doing what's cleverly called toranut, which is, you know, setting up and cleaning
correct.
Up and taking care of stuff. And for at least 2 weeks, each of those kids is so
correct.
Much better at picking up their own stuff.
Picking up their own stuff, cleaning up, but also being able to say thank you for our food.
Yeah.
yeah. Right, and understanding where that comes from.
A sense of gratitude. So here's a funny question.
Yeah.
You know, organisms that don't change die. Mm-hmm. Life is change. Camps change.
Yes.
So, you know, you've got all your traditions and you got the songs and you did it perfectly last year or as close as you could get it, and now it's a new year. And how much change do you allow? The kids want to change it. The staff wants to change it. But they also want
the same. Constantly changing. Here's the funny thing. It's constantly changing. However, in their eyes, they think that it's always been done this way, right? But it's constantly changing. We are, as a full-time senior staff, as soon as the summer is over, we're already thinking about, all right, how can we make it better? What did we do that worked? What didn't work? How can we make it better? Right. What new thing do we want to introduce? How do we kind of maneuver that, right? I'll give you an example. It used to be that our oldest campers were entering 10th grade, and then you became a CIT, a counselor in training, in 11th grade, and then you were an assistant counselor in 12th grade. In 2005, we introduced a gap year, right? Where after you were a camper entering 10th grade, you took a year off of camp. You didn't come back to camp as a CIT. You had to do something else. We really pushed a trip to Israel, right, with the NFTI, which is the National Federation of Temple Youth, the part of the Reform Movement's youth division. But it wasn't essential. We wanted you to do something for yourself, right? Personal growth of some sort. And everybody said, you're going to destroy camp. You're never going to get any kids to come back for CIT. Or nobody's going to want to do it. That's not
lose
how
the
we
momentum.
Do it.
Yes, it's not how we do it here. That's
it. Not how we do it. So then the first year we had 7 kids go to Israel. Everybody says, see, you're destroying camp. What are you going to do? The next year we had 20 kids. The year after that, 40 kids. And now we consistently send between 40 and 50 kids to Israel every summer. And as far as they're concerned, that's the way it's always been done.
Right. Gap year, we all know about this.
Always been done. That's just the way it is. So
from Mount Sinai.
Exactly. Absolutely. Everything from Mount Sinai, Mount Sinai, Mount Sinai. And, you know, but at the same time, you have alumni who come back, or we have alumni Shabbat, where the people who can come back and celebrate Shabbat with us, they're, oh, my goodness, look at all the singing, looking at all the dancing. I can't believe
that. We didn't
do
it that
way. We didn't
do
it that
way.
We do it. And so there's always that, right? So everything's like, we are constantly trying to evolve and change, right? Make it better.
One of the really special aspects of camp always is music.
Yes.
And talk a little bit about how that evolves and how it changes, because there's a whole, you know, song leader hierarchy.
Correct.
And some of the music is the same music that you can hear at any Reform camp.
Nice.
Or many synagogues, and some of it's really not. Speaking music, as a former camp.
Former, you're right. Music, I personally believe that music is one of the most important experiences of summer camp, of Jewish summer camp, because that's, of all of our senses in connection to camp, when you hear a certain song or a certain melody or a certain prayer, it brings you right back to those moments, right? I hear that all the time, that
it's very evocative.
Oh, absolutely. You know, a few years ago, we honored one of our great song leaders, song directors, music directors, Chuck Feldman.
Chuck Feldman, right. An old family friend.
Right, where we honored him, and hundreds of people came back. Right? And it was a big sing-along and everything, and you could just see that they were transported. Right? Transported back when they were kids,
yeah,
to sing these songs and all the memories and
they
feelings.
They were 14 again.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And that, you know, music, among all of the things that, maybe the smells or the food or the stories or whatever, music really does that. So music, we use that as a great teaching tool, because you have your overt kind of Jewish learning music. We have Jewish themed music, or even just music for the sake of music, for dancing and having a really great time, right? But all in the context of this Jewish space. So regardless of the music, it's still going to feel Jewish to you, based on the fact that it's going to transport you back to this place, to the people, to the friends, to the experience, and so on. Kind of like these concentric circles of experience.
I want to thank Rabbi David Eshel for a great visit here on 2 Jewish. If people want to find out more about your camps, what's the best place to go to? What's the website?
Come to our website, wbtcamps.org.
It's great. And by the way, all Jewish camps are good.
All Jewish camps are good. Absolutely. You know what? All Jewish camping is good. just send your children to camp. Send them to us, absolutely, but send your kids to camp.
You heard it here on Too Jewish. Thanks very much, Rabbi.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest for our 11th anniversary show will be Rick Moranis, star of the movies Little Shop of Horrors, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Ghostbusters, Spaceballs, Strange Brew, and many others. The comedian and comic who retired from show business and now has a delightful album out of songs that are all, well, too Jewish. Don't miss next Sunday's 11th anniversary show starring Rick Moranis. It'll be great. Our playout this morning comes from Rick Moranis, his infectious and quite wonderful song, Poo Poo Poo, which is about not bringing on bad luck and other things. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
We ran into the Feldman's, man, did they look great. Mindy graduated with a 3.8. Milty says they're just about to renovate. And don't tell anybody, but Debbie is late. Poo Poo Poo. To be true. Poo, poo, poo. Murray was indicted for insider trading. They moved the case to Delaware. They're sitting and waiting. Running up a legal tab, their hopes were fading. Then Murray and the judge's sister started dating. Poo, poo, poo.